And I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Friday, April 30th, 45 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, and absolutely beautiful day yesterday that we saw in Park City. And you know what? We're going to do it all over again today. Mostly sunny skies and a high temperature of 71 degrees. So it will be absolutely splendid to be outside and enjoy those nice warm temperatures. First 70 of the year in Park City, first 80s of the year for the Wasatch Front. We're going to be near 70 tomorrow, but we'll have a lot more cloud cover around here during the daytime hours, and we will likely see some type of an isolated thundershower develop over the high terrain in the afternoon and evening hours as well, ahead of a cold front that arrives early Sunday morning across northern Utah, and that is what's going to provide us with a better round of showers on Sunday, and there might even be an embedded thunderstorm or two to go with it. We'll be about 15 degrees cooler, and temperatures will be only around 54 for that daytime high in Park City on Sunday. So a little wishy-washy weekend, but we'll even be cooler on Monday with the kind of remnants of that cold front bringing in the coolest air with a high of 50, and we'll continue to have the chance of some scattered showers around Park City for your Monday. But then we start to dry back out. We start to slowly warm back up heading into the Tuesday, Wednesday timeframe, where we'll see a little bit more in the way of some sunshine out there. We'll still be in the mid to upper 50s, but by Thursday of next week, we're already back into the upper 60s under a lot more sunshine. But enjoy here today because it is really going to be quite the delight.
Okay. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
You too.
It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be talking with parent, author, and mental health activist Pete Early. He'll be presenting a session on navigating the healthcare system for loved ones with mental illness. That's coming up next Tuesday, May 4th. Then Park City Mayor Andy Bierman with a recap of last night's meeting here in the studio. Finally, Charlie Sturgis is the outgoing executive director of Mountain Trails Foundation. He'll be joined by Laura Smith, who will be succeeding him starting in June. Both of them joining us in studio. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Bill DeVille. The time machine treks back to 1988 this time, a year of excellent debuts from Tracy Chapman, Pixies, and the band Living Color. The Traveling Wilburys were launched. Public Enemy released one of the most important albums of the year. Cowboy Junkies recorded an album in a church with only one microphone. CDs outsold vinyl for the first time. It's 1988, our year on this episode of Time Machine from the Current.
Tune in to Time Machine from the Current, Saturdays at 11 a.m.
Well, with the pandemic causing problems in our supply chain, finding a bike to buy hasn't been easy. The next best thing may be this weekend's Young Riders Bike Swap. Gear check-in is happening today from 2 to 8 p.m. there at the rear of the Utah Film Studio. The executive director of Young Riders, Heinrich Dieter, says there's no better time to clean out your garage and storage areas and look to sell some of your biking inventory. Make sure that your bike is in good working order and the tires pumped for the best selling price.
We are absolutely in a seller's market. So I think, obviously bikes and inventory, but I would encourage people to, you know, go through their garage if they don't use bikes, if they bought one last year and they don't use it that much, to bring it down, make sure it's in good working condition. Because it will sell. As you may know, it's very difficult to get new bikes at the moment. It's very difficult to even get parts, chariots, bike racks, like you name it. It is everything's back. And so if you have something and you're looking to sell it, there's probably no better opportunity than right now to sell that equipment.
The sale will start bright and early Saturday morning and run all day, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. They'll be back on Sunday between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. But he says plan to go early. 80% of the goods are sold in the first couple of hours of the swap. The swap accepts just about all riding gear except helmets, so shoes, shorts, and jerseys in good condition, as well as bike racks and chariots, are good items to bring to sell. With the pandemic still going on, he says they will be spread out at the film studio and will also be taking other COVID precautions as well.
What we'll be doing in this, COVID era, we have a huge space there at the film studio, and there's a very big garage door that opens up, and it's going to be nice weather. So you know, I always let just a few people in, especially those early people. But this year we'll really focus on, you know, 20 to 25 people going in. There's staff in there to help. We'll wait and make sure that there's social distancing, et cetera. And when people come out, we'll let more people come in.
Young Writers keeps 20% of the sales price, which goes towards scholarships in the popular program. This year's summer camp sold out in less than 5 minutes. Starting this year and over the next couple of years, Young Writers will be turning over the reins of the annual bike swap to Park City High School so the athletes there can help raise the money for their team.
We are going to be working with Park City High School Mountain Biking Program. And our desire with our board and staff at Young Writers is to provide them some of that funding this year. And so they'll be volunteering and helping out, but sort of behind the scenes with us. And then next year, they'll be taking basically the lead role on it. And we'll be behind the scenes, you know, for a year holding hands. And then the year after that, it's theirs. And we think that that is a great community program. You know, we take kids from 6 to, say, 11 years old. And at 11 and 12, they roll into that program. Unfortunately, they don't have a fundraiser at the moment, and they have a lot of coaches and they have a lot of kids. So I think they need the money probably more than we do at the moment. And this has always been a community event, and I think it's appropriate that we try to help them out.
That's the executive director of the Young Writers, Heinrich Dieters. Again, you can find out more information by going online to youngwriters.com. KPCW News Time now, 8:12.
Current and relevant information matters. To let you know what is going on around you, locally, nationally, and internationally, KPCW makes this happen with this nonprofit news organization. With underwriting, KPCW can get the message about your business to our informed and dedicated listeners. Want to support the local news hour and NPR's morning edition? We're looking for a few more sponsors. For information about this program and all underwriting opportunities, contact Emily at kpcw.org.
It's 8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, coming up on Tuesday, the Wasatch County Community Coalition is presenting author, journalist, and parent Pete Early. He'll be presenting via Zoom a discussion titled Navigating the Healthcare System for Loved Ones with Mental Illness. He joins me now on the phone. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm delighted.
Yeah. So why don't you start, Pete, if you would, by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm the proud father of a son with serious mental illness. My son became sick in college. I tried to get him help, rushed him to emergency room, was told that he wasn't dangerous enough, bring him back when he tries to hurt someone, believe it or not. And 24 hours later, he broke into a stranger's house. Luckily, no one was there. He broke in to take a bubble bath. And I was so angry. I had worked as a reporter at the Washington Post, and I had a lot of contacts. And they said to me, well, you should write about this. So I spent 10 months in the jail in Miami-Dade because we have 365,000 people with serious mental illness now in our jails and in our prisons, and it's often called the new asylums. And I wrote a book about it, and I charted my son's journey. It was lasted for 6 years, from multiple hospitalizations, arrests, tasers, to finally full recovery. And so that's what I'll be speaking about, hoping to give other parents hope that they can get through this.
Yeah. So your son diagnosed with what?
Well, you know, these are insurance terms. The problem with mental illness, Leslie, is it's whatever the doctor sees at that moment, and unfortunately, most doctors only take 15 minutes because they're just going to prescribe medication. And so he's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is a mood disorder. You know, you go from thinking you're great to not wanting to get out of bed. Schizoaffective disease, which is kind of a bridge between bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, which is a thought disorder. And the difference is between a mood and a thought disorder is you actually hear voices, you see people who might not be there. And those bipolar and schizophrenia, depending on how he showed himself that day, he got that diagnosis. So it's a very, it's one of those things that's hard to diagnose. And I know Utah, having been out there and read studies, you actually have a higher rate of mental illness than the national average. And so that's one of the reasons I'm glad to come out, because parents are just, they don't know what to do. I mean, most of us have a family doctor. We don't have a psychiatrist, most of us. And when these, all of a sudden, the person you knew from birth is a complete stranger and talking nonsense, and you look at them, and it's just so heartbreaking because we throw barriers, you know, to getting them help that they need, legal barriers, and also just, you know, I read a study getting prepared for your interview. 30% of people in Utah have serious mental illness, didn't get any help last year. And there's a variety of reasons for that, but these are sick people who need our help.
Yeah. So you say your son's in full recovery? That's remarkable then.
Yeah, it took 6 years, but he finally was able. The first step, and what I'll be talking about, I mean, if people want to register, they should go to the Caring Community Coalition of Wasatch County on Facebook. But the first step was him finally admitting he had a mental illness. And that's a huge thing because there's so much stigma. And who wants to admit that their brain, you know, isn't working right? But after 6 hospitalizations, and I said the last time he was walking down the street naked because he thought that taking off your clothes made him invisible. But that time he got, and I'm glad Utah has these services, he got picked up by a crisis intervention team trained officer. And the officer, my son said, don't handcuff me. That's when I got tasered. I'm not a criminal. And the officer used his discretion and just put him in a squad car. And then he said to him, believe it or not, Leslie, he said, what kind of music you like? And my son said, oh, I like rap. And so the officer turned his radio to a rap station. And when my son got to the emergency room, he said, gee, this is better than a taxi ride. So he had a warm handoff. And the doctors there then worked with him to try to find the right medication that did had the fewest side effects. And then he got a wonderful case manager. And she said, you know, you shouldn't live with your father. You need housing. And she got him into an apartment with 2 guys with schizophrenia. And I was shocked at how that pride and having an apartment really affected him. Then she said, you need a job. And he said, well, I can't work. And she said, knock it off. And she got him into training to be what's called a peer-to-peer specialist, a person with mental illness who helps others. And he went from being someone who needed help to someone who helped others. And that was a key in all of this. And today, he's just earned his master's degree in social work, and he works full-time in for the county as someone who goes out and helps people with mental illness.
Well, that's a great story, yeah, and very successful. As I think you referred to, you have documented your experience during those tough 6 years. In the book, I believe, is The Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. And
yeah.
And crazy not referring to the person, just the system.
The system, yeah. And I was fortunate. It was one of 3 finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. But the reason I'm so proud of it is that other parents have come up to me and said, you're telling my story. And it helped get congressional action to pass through some mental health, one of the biggest mental health laws in recent times. And it's not because I'm a great writer. It's because this is such a problem. I can guarantee you have a listener right now who is desperate to try to figure out how to help someone they love get the services that they're going to need. And we know that the sooner you act on this, the better. And that these diseases, even schizophrenia, they're highly recoverable. You can recover from, but you need the kind of help that hopefully is available through People's Health Clinic and others to get people moving forward with their lives. And unfortunately, we let too many just fall through the streets. Last time I was in Salt Lake City, I saw people wandering around your streets, clearly psychotic. And that's, you know, that's shameful.
Yeah. I guess, is navigating the healthcare system, though, any different when dealing with mental health issues than it is for, say, somebody with cancer?
I mean, oh, yes.
Why?
Absolutely.
And why so?
Well, first of all, we already talked about it, is getting a diagnosis. And second of all, because of our horrific past with our state hospitals where people were locked up and basically warehoused, We instituted much-needed laws to protect a person from being forced into treatment. And this is what happened with my son. My son had his breakdown. He was wandering around New York for 5 days. He hadn't slept. He was convinced God had him on a secret mission to save Natalie Portman. And I rushed, he said to me, "How would you feel, Dad, if someone killed himself?" And I rushed him to an emergency room. We were put in a separate room for 4 hours. You want to talk about differences? The average wait time for a non-threatening emergency in an emergency room today is 4 hours if you go in and it's non-life-threatening. The average time for a mental health problem is 4 days. I'm not kidding. You wait 4 days, often chained to a gurney in California, to get a hospital bed. But anyway, the doctor said, "Look, you waited 4 hours. There's no danger." And my son knew who the president was. He knew what crying over spilt milk was. And he said, "Because there's no danger, most states, including Utah, require either gravely disabled, unable to care for themselves, or a danger to self or others. And you cannot help someone who's not thinking clearly, who doesn't realize they're sick, unless they become dangerous," which is why we have so many people in jails and prisons or on our streets. And so he said, you know, bring him back after he hurts someone. Well, that's the last thing you should be telling people. So if you go in and get cancer, there's a regimen. Okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do chemo. We're going to do whatever. In mental health, first of all, you got to get the person who's sick to admit they need help. And then what kind of help is available? My son's had 7 psychiatrists. Only 2 have bothered to learn any more than his name. That's because they're only going to meet with him 15 minutes, give a diagnosis, bipolar, prescribe medicine, and shove him out the door and let a social worker take care of him. But treating the mind requires treating the heart. It's so dehumanizing to have someone who doesn't even know you say, "Oh, yeah, well, you have a life-threatening, you have a illness here that may end up with you being homeless, may end up with you not being able to work, may end up with you getting arrested, and I know all this within 15 minutes, even though I know nothing about you." That's dehumanizing. And so we set up barriers to helping parents and other loved ones get someone who becomes ill help.
All right. Again, that book is Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Again, this event is happening Tuesday, 6:45, and as you noted, the link can be found on the Caring Community Coalition Facebook page. how will this work? I mean, will you tell a little bit about your story and then just opening it up for a discussion?
Yeah, I'm so thrilled they're having me out. I'm going to talk and tell my son's story and how he got help and what works. And that's going to take about, 30 minutes, 26 minutes. And then I'm going to be available on Zoom to answer questions and see how I can help. Now, I'm not an expert on Utah, but unfortunately, I serve on a panel that advises Congress about this, and I have my own. I've been to 49 states and 5 foreign countries, toured over 100 programs. And so I'm not a doctor, but I'm trying to impart things that you can do to try what worked with my son and why he finally accepted treatment and why the services he got were so, so important. And give people hope, because without hope, there's a famous statement about how long you can last without water, air, and when we have no hope, you can't last at all. You know, we all have to have hope in our lives.
Yeah. I would also direct people to your very impressive website. You've got a number of blog articles there, and one caught my eye there with a link showing the roadmap to the ideal crisis system. It shows actually how a community, a step-by-step blueprint about how a community can create this ideal system. Can you talk a little, what is an ideal crisis system, and is this something that, I mean, we're talking about communities like Park City, Midway, Heber should have?
Sure. And that, you know, I hope the people in Park City who are very progressive take a look at this. And basically what's happening is we're about to change over to a crisis care hotline number. Instead of the suicide number, it's going to be 988. That's going to be national. That's what you call. But we're trying to expand it into any kind of crisis. And the idea is that we have people available with technology so that if I call up 988 and I say, oh my gosh, my son is saying stuff that doesn't make sense, or oh my gosh, my son's holding a knife to my throat. You know, those are two different crises. But you'll have people who are trained at triaging calls. More importantly, they will have access, immediate access, to saying, okay, you're depressed. And we know that 1 in 10 people in Utah in the last year because of COVID had said they have anxiety and depressive disorder. Okay, you may need to see someone to talk to. How about next, you know, tomorrow or next week, depending on your need, here's a doctor. They can see you. I got it scheduled. You show up. If someone calls up and says, oh, my son, like my son had chased my ex-wife into the bathroom and she was locked in there, scared to death, then they can send what's called a mobile crisis response team, which are trained professionals, not the police, trained professionals who can go over and talk to the person and diagnose, and they have tools that can help them, if necessary, take them to a hospital. And that's the next thing is, rather than going to an emergency room, setting up community-based centers that are welcoming, that have peers like my son there who try to get a person in, and then ultimately, if everything else fails, dealing with trained police officers who can de-escalate a situation and get people into help. And ultimately, if someone needs crisis care, they can get a bed. You know, it's almost impossible to get a bed in this country today if you have a mental illness. I mentioned 4 days wait. But get them access. Try to be warm, welcoming, warm handoffs. Recognize these are people who need help. And only in the extreme, force them into hospitals and force the police to be the first responders.
Okay. I'm about out of time. Pete, I appreciate your time. Again, you will be online 6:45 Tuesday, May 4th. People can find out more by going to the Caring Community Coalition Facebook page. Thanks again for your time.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
KPCW News Time now, 8:28. It's the local news hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:28. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW local news hour. Well, the Park City Council meeting yesterday, and in the studio with a recap, I've got Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good to see you.
Let's see. I need you on that mic. Thanks.
Okay. We'll try again. Good
that
morning,
sounds a
Leslie.
Lot better. Thanks. So let's see. July 4th, City Council started off with a work session about the 4th of July celebration in town. Staff presenting a number of options, including alternate dates for both the parade and fireworks. So it sounds like the council doesn't support a weekend parade. The 4th, of course, is on a Sunday, and leaving Friday, July 2nd, KPCW's birthday, as our celebration day?
I think that's appropriate. We should have a parade for you. No, for years we've been hearing from the public that the 4th of July has grown too much and it's not a local event anymore. And then on top of that, there's still concerns coming out of the pandemic, having that many people come from the Wasatch Front and put us at risk. So what we talked about is alternatives. We certainly don't want to cancel the parade, but we thought maybe hosting it on July 2nd, which is a Friday morning, would be more locally oriented. So we heard from council that's what they'd like to pursue. So staff's going to come back with a formal proposal on that, but that's the direction.
So is this kind of a dry run then for other community events?
I think it could be. We're trying things right now. We're hearing strongly from the public that the tourism versus residents is out of balance coming out of COVID. We have a chance to reimagine ourselves and try to fix some of those things. So we're trying stuff. So I just ask our residents to be patient. There are a lot of things we're trying that are going to be different. And we tend to be a community resistant to change. At the very same time, we're being changed by external forces. So we're going to push back. We're going to try things. And we need to hear from the public whether it works or not, and we'll continue it or try something else.
Okay, so would we do like the fireworks also on Friday the 2nd, or would we move those to the Saturday the 3rd? Or
the thought with the fireworks is we'd do them on the 3rd, which is concurrent with the canyons, and we think that's going to spread people out between the two venues. We expect a weekend, with or without events, we expect it to be a very busy weekend. And certainly anybody that's worried that we might chase people away by not having the parade, I think we're going to bring people here with the fireworks. So, again, we're trying to split the difference.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do we, given the fact that it is such a busy, big economic week for town, I mean, how do we balance those health measures and scaled back events with the businesses relying on the business?
That's going to be the challenge all summer, and I encourage folks that we're going to have to be adaptable at this point. We're getting good news out of the CDC where they're saying it's relatively safe to be outdoors and around people, so we think that we can dip our toe into events, and we're just going to have to monitor things. If we have problems with variant viruses and spikes, we may have to cancel events or make further accommodations, but we were talking that through with the Silly Market last week. This week at our meeting, they were talking about all the measures they have in place, and Councilman Joyce brought up that you may not even need to do all those as we go into the summer, but it's better to plan for the worst and then be pleasantly surprised if we can ease off.
Yeah. So any concern, though, that scheduling activities the whole week can bring even more people to town?
It's always a risk, but Friday morning, most people are going to have to work. They're going to take Monday off. So we think it'll be there for the locals. And again, we're trying it. And if it turns out to not work as well as we want, we don't have to do it next year.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Silly Market then. The council later on did approve that supplemental plan. And of course, no market last year due to the pandemic. So any changes coming to the 2021 edition, or is it?
Well, at least the first four markets, they're planning on scaling back. I think they're taking out about a third of their booths, so there's going to be better spacing. It's likely going to be concurrent with car-free Main Street, so we feel like people will spread out on the entire street. You'll have folks at Silly Market, but also flowing through Upper Main Street as well. And then they've got a whole bunch of COVID tracing measures and policies in place that they're going to begin the market with. And again, we're going to have to evaluate as it goes.
Yeah, and since the city can't really enforce health orders in the near future, can the market, though, enforce their own COVID protocols?
I think they're limited in what they can do there. They're certainly going to ask for cooperation, but I think we're all going to have that challenge in that the state, they've set the standards where they essentially declare the pandemic over, and we're very close to that. In the next week, we'll likely hit that. And at that point, it becomes a personal accountability thing. And if people aren't comfortable, they may not choose to put themselves in those situations right now.
All right, let's move on to the Arts and Culture District. Deputy City Manager David Everett leading more discussion on the financial plans and the scope of the proposed district. It sounds now like the council may be moving away from tapping into the additional resort city sales tax. How come?
Yeah. Well, that's something that we had concern from council members, and we had concern from the public. And there's been a lot of talk. In the fall, when we were looking at this project, we realized that costs were escalating. And so staff came to us with a phasing proposal to make it work. And we heard from council and some of the stakeholders and partners, they wanted to see the whole thing. They didn't want to see a phased piecemeal approach. So we spent the winter laying out the entire proposal, and I would say an aspirational fashion, knowing fully well that we couldn't afford it all. And that brought out new voices. It got us a lot of good feedback. Now, what we've done, David and his team have been very active the last 3 weeks, taking all that feedback from stakeholders, from the public, and from council, and putting together a couple of scenarios. And those were laid out last night. Those were much more on a budget. We're looking at the scenarios that council preferred and asked him to come back with are probably in that $55 to $65 million range. They don't tap into the additional resort tax, and they don't leverage the TRT quite as far. So we think that that's a budget range that we can do this responsibly, and now it's just a matter of figuring out phasing that makes sense and how many of the community wants and needs we can fit in there.
Yeah. So does that then open up more money for other projects? It does.
It leaves us flexibility. That resort tax in the past has gone towards open space purchases. So if something were to open up, it leaves us flexibility there. Leaves us flexibility for the downtown improvements or other districts. And it also, one of the other ways we're looking at this is it won't tap as deeply into the housing fund to do the Arts and Culture District, which leaves us more money to move things along on Homestake or Woodside or one of our other proposed projects.
And that was, you mentioned three different construction scenarios, one with scaled back buildings and only 23 housing units to start, one with no housing whatsoever, and then, of course, the one building everything at once. Where did council come down on that?
Scenario two with no housing was taken off the table pretty much. So we were looking at scenario one with some housing added in, or scenario three with potentially one or two buildings taken out. In particular, on that southeast corner, we had a building that was going to be sort of our transit center gathering area. And the thought was that if we don't build that right away, we leave that open, we buff it out as kind of a public park with public art and a gathering space, then we leave that flexible. And as the district evolves, we can decide what we need and come back and put it there. And then there was discussion that the next building in, we might do the same thing depending on our budget and our needs.
All right. So as you mentioned, I mean, if this is scaled back, then the council does have an opportunity to look at some of the homestake or perhaps phase two of the Woodside homes. Where are we? What's the status of those two projects?
Woodside's being redesigned right now, and I think council's going to see some new proposals back shortly. And homestake, that was where we targeted to try to do a public-private partnership, and I believe we have a request for proposal that's going to go out to some interesting parties very soon here. So we're going to explore that. And the good news, if we don't leverage ourselves as far on the Arts and Culture District, we maintain a significant war chest that if we can't find a private or a nonprofit partner to work with us on homestake, we still have the ability as the city to move forward.
All right. So how close are we to taking a vote about how we move forward on this?
On the Arts and Culture District? Mm-hmm. I think it's somebody asked me that the other day, and I think sort of like the design, it's an iterative process. Council's hitting various points where we're giving directions and continuing to move forward. I'm encouraged by yesterday's meeting, and that I think the gulf we had between the financial gulf and the disagreement between council and the community and the concerns, I think we bridged that mostly. I think we're circling around a budget we can work with, a concept we can work with. So next meeting, we'll probably settle on a scenario, and then it's important we meet with our stakeholders and we find out timelines for Kimball and Sundance because they're pivotal to moving forward. But then we'll enter into an extensive design phase, and then we still have to go through the whole planning commission process. So I've had some people say, well, why are we letting ourselves off? Or, you know, why aren't we looking at this like we're looking at PEG and the base development? And my answer is because we're at the start of the project, not to that point. So there's going to be lots more time for public input.
Okay. Let's see. Restriping on Park Avenue is scheduled to begin May 12th. This is part of the Park Avenue Redesign Pilot Program. So how much change is really happening there?
Well, we've got some ideas in terms of we would like to remove parking on Park Avenue, some parking, and make it much more pedestrian and bike friendly. And Park Avenue is slated for major reconstruction, probably an $8 million reconstruction. And before we do that and make these changes, we wanted to test them. So we're going to start this summer with paint. We've been working with the businesses and the residents on that street on a plan, and council has settled on one. We're going to go out there. We're going to paint it. We're going to try it, and hopefully that'll inform us before we do any major physical changes in a couple of years.
So what's that entail, that major construction project?
Well, we've got a bunch of water utilities and other utilities under there that are going to have to be redone. It's going to be a regrading of the road. I mean, it's going to be an intrusive project.
All right. And any concern that this new street design causing any illegal parking then on those busy special event days?
You know, we're going to have to continue to work with our partners like Silly Market. They've agreed to no longer have their vendors park on Park Avenue, and it's going to be an adjustment. The residents are somewhat split. I think we've got a small majority of them that favor this particular approach in terms of the removal of parking, and we have other ones that are concerned. So we're going to have to permit that. It's going to take more active management by the city, and we'll see how it goes. And if it's not working, it's just paint.
Okay. Anything else from the agenda that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I want to bring up there's been some sudden concern about the new landfill to contain the Bevel excluded soils on the Gordo parcel. There were some robocalls that went out to people and some misinformation that was spread. So we tried to have a rapid response, a Q&A on Facebook earlier this week. But anyone that has questions on that, I encourage them to go to the city website. We've posted some FAQs about what we're doing out there and what is myth and what is true, and they're welcome to reach out. But But the short version of that is we have soils all over town for a decade plus. We've been looking for a safe place to put those. And so we've been temporarily storing those soils for that decade on the Gordo parcel. Working with the EPA and the state, we decided the best thing to do was to put a lined Class 1 landfill in there and store them right on site, as well as additional soils from road projects, the arts and culture, and probably make that available for small residential projects.
Yeah. Any idea who those robocalls are being paid for by? I mean, the call came from Moab.
Yeah, we really don't know. I mean, somebody's obviously activated on this. And for us, it's just important that our residents know what we're trying to accomplish and what the true risks are. So we encourage them to go to our website, get that information, or reach out directly.
Yeah, and you guys are moving forward with it. So it's a done deal?
Well, the state has a comment period, and I think that comment period goes through May 5th. So if anybody has thoughts, I encourage them to weigh in. I've asked staff to put a link on the city facts site. So that should be up this afternoon, that they can get a direct link to the DEQ, which is who it permits this at the state. But yes, thus far it looks positive. The council is asked to move forward. The state has been favorable about giving us a permit, but they do wait till they get all the public feedback before they make it formal.
Okay. And just another month before the candidate filing period starts, have you again made a final decision? It seems like you're yes, and then maybe not.
I thought I'd been pretty clear. I really didn't want to start campaigning at the start of the year. So I told folks I was strongly leading towards it. But yes, very soon here, I will be making a formal announcement. And I've been talking to a lot of folks, getting a lot of encouragement. So I do plan to run again. That's what the announcement will say.
Okay. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time Now, 842. KPCW News Time Now, 8:43. Good morning. Well, the Utah Department of Transportation wants feedback from residents, businesses, and officials who are working and living in the Heber Valley. The UDOT Environmental Impact Study for the bypass road will begin this spring, that after the second round of input is received. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
UDOT has finished what they call their early scoping process after holding informational meetings last summer and compiling public comments. The Environmental Impact Study is part of the National Environmental Policy Act, required when federal funds finance roads or highways. UDOT announced they'll begin their environmental impact evaluation, which will consider a bypass road around Heber City's downtown commercial area. UDOT Senior Communications Manager Jeff Dupay said public input is critical for the process to succeed. Heber City's Main Street Business District is bisected by Utah State Road 40, cutting through the commercial area. Dupay said UDOT uses the same process when considering similar communities throughout the state.
So the study is funded by the Utah Department of Transportation. It was funding that was allocated by the Transportation Commission for this specific study. It's being paid for with state dollars. It's about $3 million for this study. And as far as the notice of intent, because this EIS process, it follows the process that's established by the National Environmental Policy Act, that notice of intent is what officially starts the EIS process.
The Heber Valley Corridor EIS team has filed the notice of intent in the Federal Register.
This is actually fairly common when you're looking at any type of transportation improvement along a main street that is also either a state or a federal route. That's why we followed the same type of vigorous process to make sure that decisions are feasible and reasonable, and at the same time they take into consideration the community needs, because it's all about quality of life. These transportation solutions need to provide choices that help support community needs. Otherwise, it can be detrimental to how a community grows and develops.
UDOT held a virtual public meeting in August, which garnered extensive public comments. You can find a link to the comments on kpcw.org. Dupay said the public comment period starts April 30th and closes June 14th. He said all comments must be in writing and submitted through email to hebervalleyeis.udot.utah.gov or by calling 801-210-0498.
There's no shortcuts. We still follow the process, because it's the process that helps establish the future transportation solutions that may be needed in order to improve mobility in the Heber Valley area.
DuPay will present the EIS updates to the Heber City Council on May 4th, the Wasatch County Council on May 5th, and the Wasatch County Interlocal Meeting on May 26th. You can find links to the meetings on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
It's 8:47 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as we've reported earlier this week, Laura Smith has been tapped to serve as the new executive director of Mountain Trails Foundation. She'll be succeeding Charlie Sturgis starting in June. Both of them joining me now in studio. Good morning and congratulations, Laura.
Good morning. Thank you.
Congratulations on retirement.
Thank you, Leslie, and good morning.
Good morning. So when do you officially start then?
Well, I think she's officially started. The handoff is in process. I mean, if it had been someone, an outsider, they would have also probably had to get rid of, you know, move on from their other job, things like that. So one of the benefits, certainly with Laura as a person who's been an almost 9 years staffer at Mountain Trails, is that the handoff is going to be a lot simpler.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, you pretty much know the job.
Yeah, I know most of it. I've kind of made the analogy that Charlie flies at 30,000, and I've been flying between 5 and 25,000, so there's just a little jump up there to get to where Charlie's been in the community, so yeah.
Yeah, so at this point, then, you're going to need to hire a replacement for you.
I am. The word's out.
Okay, so that job's been posted as well?
Not yet. You just helped with that greatly. Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. You did. And we don't know what that job really looks like. So some of Laura's duties probably will stay the same because she's a good at them and likes doing some of them. And some of them I think she'll want to maybe pass on to somebody else. And I'm sure a lot of that's basically focused on the bookkeeping, accounting side of our lives.
Sure. So any ideas, though, Laura? I mean, as you kind of look into this new chapter and in terms of things, ideas that you'd like to implement?
Yeah, you know, I think that my first thing is to rely on Mountain Trails' longtime success and just build on that. We have a lot, as you know, coming down the pike as far as development in our area, not just Park City, but regionally. So, you know, addressing trails needs in other communities that are close by, like, you know, the Jordan Hill area. And there's always the in-town stuff that needs to be taken care of and expanded and maybe made a little bit more efficient. I would point to the Bonanza Flat area as one of the places we've tried to expand and make a good difference in trail access. So.
Okay. So Charlie, what's next for you then?
Well, I've been testing out going to Moab and St. George a lot lately. I'm hopefully we'll just be able to ratchet it back a little bit, not have maybe so many things kind of chopping up the schedule, and really, given the opportunity, I really like to focus on some just climbing in general and a little more biking. I know it sounds funny to, you know, maybe think about being healthier, you know, like stretch, things like that you never get around to. So, actually spend more time with Kathy and hopefully, you know, we got out some with Leah and her boyfriend to the desert to do some climbing. And so those kinds of things that, you know, kind of get backburnered a little bit when you're running around trying to do everything else. It'd be nice to have some of that everything else out of the way and just go hang out with the family some and some other friends. And so looking forward to, and also just literally hanging out. I mean, this last week, I was just down in Moab. The idea of being rained out for an entire day actually didn't seem so bad. So
you started, you took over in what, 08?
2010.
10.
May of 2010.
Yeah. And since then, so just 11 year, any idea how many miles of trail we added under your tenure here?
No, I would really not want to guess. I mean, Rick might have a better idea, but I would bet, well, let me just throw it out there. We probably have added 30 to 40 miles of trails overall. I think more important is also, you know, we certainly were upping our maintenance game, catching up on old trails. We certainly have been, as an organization, and as sort of as Laura was pointing out, we've been involved more regionally, you know, with the Forest Service groups and with our local Wasatch County, South Summit Trails. We've certainly been involved in stuff with the at the governor's level for the I'm sorry, Laura, what's the outdoor Utah outdoor rec meetings or summits. Yeah. And org, yes.
The
yeah.
Office of Outdoor Recreation.
Yeah, Office of Outdoor
close,
Recreation.
You're close,
yeah.
That's a big mouthful.
Yeah, I keep confusing it with the governor's. But anyhow, so yeah, I think those are, you know, we've had a lot of accomplishments. We've moved into a pretty crazy building situation, which the burden of finishing that up is going to be on Laura. And it was also to Laura's credit that we actually found that building and are super psyched about just what it does for Mountain Trails in terms of efficiency. I mean, having huge repair space and just raw dirt driveway space has been incredibly important already.
Yeah, have you found any roommates?
Not yet, but we're looking around. It's a little bit specific. It really needs to be a nonprofit for the other side, and we have we've talked with the city a little bit about some of their machinery storage needs, and same with the basin. And we also, you know, when we started down this road 5-6 years ago, we also were looking at, is there some kind of nonprofit co-op thing that can be done? Can you subdivide the spaces and actually make it work? And that's still on the table. And we have talked to one or two nonprofits about that in the past.
So is it just a lease at this point, or a lease to own? Or
it's a lease with an option to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 3 years to consummate. And it would behoove us to really make that happen. And I think it should be relatively easy to make. Well, I don't want to say easy to make happen. It does take some fundraising, but I think if the community recognizes the importance of us having a long-term home base that improves our efficiency and so forth going into the future, especially as we head towards the Olympics and some of the space crunches you get from that, I think it's going to be really important that we actually own our home.
Yeah. So anything that you kind of didn't get finished, didn't see through?
Yeah, the Wow Trail. So, no, you know, if I had some things on my hit list, I still like to see the connection go to the Great Western from up in Bonanza Flat. As a big pipe dream, and I think, at the state level, they're looking at it a little bit more now, is actually, you know, what can we do to make the Great Western more of a ride-through? Some of that. And, you know, the thing that's lingering out there right now that I'll probably still take up some of the battle on is I have this thing that the manufacturing side of most of the activities, most of the recreational sports we do, really need to step up their game and take responsibility for the etiquette and the way their equipment that they manufacture is used in the public world. And I think that if we can engage people on better etiquette and better riding techniques or running techniques or skiing techniques before they arrive here, we'll have a better trail experience for everybody.
Yeah. So what are you referring to? I mean, where?
Literally code of ethics, you know, I'd like to see a mountain biking code of ethics be on the handlebars of the bike when it leaves the factory.
Interesting. Okay. You got a trail report for us?
Sure. It's great out there. Have a good week. And, you know, it's pretty obvious. We never ride above 8,000 feet at this point. It'll still be wet and snowy generally until June 1. So don't get too impatient. But there's so much good riding opening up down low. And it's also a great opportunity to maybe try some trails elsewhere nearby. I mean, if you've been to Draper but you haven't been to Harriman, maybe that's a good thing to go check out. Coyote, as much as that is open, is good, and Dutch Hollow. And so I think we have a lot of riding to go do. So just get out there and enjoy it. Get some mileage.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'm just excited for the next phase of Mountain Trails.
Okay. Charlie?
Leslie, I'm really excited for Laura to be able to take over. People say they're big shoes. I don't know that big, but she has a lot of strength and a lot of determination, so I think she can take over pretty easily.
Okay. Charlie, Laura, right. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Okay.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:56. Got mostly sunny skies, looking for a high today of 71, currently 46 degrees. We've got some clouds and isolated thunderstorms tomorrow. And just a bit cooler, though. 69 is the expected high for Saturday. More showers, though, and colder temperatures, dropping by about 15 degrees on Sunday with a high of about 54. Cooler with a high of 50 on Monday with a chance of some scattered showers. But looks like things are going to finally dry out and warm back up starting on Tuesday and Wednesday. KPCW News Time now, 8:57. Good morning. Well, both Park City Municipal and Summit County officials have indicated that they are open to the idea of extending at least a part-time remote work model, that after the COVID-19 pandemic ends. KPCW's Sean Higgins has details.
Despite all of the bad things that came from the COVID-19 pandemic, there were a few silver linings. One in particular was reshaping how many employers and employees see how they get their work done on a daily basis. With thousands of employers in non-person-to-person industries shifting to a work-from-home model over the last 13 months, some have begun to question the necessity of employees at desks in an office, including local governments here in the Wasatch Back. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher said the plan is to have at least some form of remote work continue for county employees into the foreseeable future.
We've learned so much over the last year of how we can do this, not only from the employee standpoint and how we equip employees to be able to do that, how our systems are now in place in order to support that, but also how to manage it. The benefit is that it's opened us up to a lot more possibilities of work schedules that people can work. We can recruit people a little bit differently in some positions. We even have the possibility of looking at some positions that would be 100% remote, depending on the job duties of that position.
Fisher said work schedules will be looked at on a department-by-department and employee-by-employee basis. For example, a job with no significant public-facing aspect to it, like an accountant, could see much of their work continue to be remote. A more public employee, like Fisher himself, would likely see more required office time. Park City Manager Matt Dias echoed Fisher's sentiments and added that pre-pandemic, city staff was actually starting to outgrow the Marsac building in Park City, which used to be an elementary school and is now recognized as an historic site. He said continuing some sort of remote work model could actually save the public significant amounts of money if expensive building renovations or expansions for employee offices at City Hall are no longer necessary. As a bonus, the city could also cast a wider net when it comes to hiring for open positions.
We may have an opportunity here to create some shared workspaces, which would forego the necessity to either build an annex or make a major renovation or even build a new facility to try to provide all the services that the community is demanding us. So in the long run, I actually look at this as a savings for the public. I look at this as a way to increase or improve our ability to compete for qualified employees and competent employees, and maybe reduce some of the rates of our attrition and beat back on the affordability component of this community.
That's Park City City Manager Matt Dias. Again, 52 degrees here in Old Town Park City, looking for mostly clear skies and sunny with a high today of 70. This is KPCW Park City Now, time for news.